who does he, meaning me, the instructor, target as greedy? And on page 9 of the Capitalism and Socialism handout, it says, who is more greedy? The businessman who wants to get the best price and the greatest profit when he produces something of value in the marketplace? Or the person who votes themselves benefits they haven't earned by checking a box on a ballot? And here you look at what is this person, the person who is voting themselves benefits. They want something for nothing. They're voting for government largesse skimmed off the top of productive businesses and people, as opposed to the businessman who's actually offering a good or service and wants to trade it for money. And it's a lot easier to check a box on a ballot or get together a bunch of people and wave signs or call up your congressman and ask him to support a piece of legislation, a special tax, or some new benefit or subsidy for some supposed social good. What's more difficult is to address the problem yourself through a voluntary charity to try to actually fix the problem and use your own money, or to try to raise money to address the problem, or to actually go into business and try to produce a profit. So it's the welfare state voter who wants to help himself to some of the businessman's money, which he didn't earn, who's the greedy one, not the businessman, who wants to make a profit in meeting consumer needs. Why should you beware of college professors? Because they're predominantly on the left, because they are unionized government employees with a vested interest in you accepting a particular kind of worldview which supports a large welfare state, including huge subsidies for government-sponsored education. Also, most college professors, they have never worked in the private sector. They've never had to make a payroll. And very often, and they go straight from being a student to being a college professor and have never worked outside of academia. And so they have a lot of interesting economic theories and theories about the way the world is run. But this is often just tradition from their professors and from textbooks and politically and ideologically driven schools of education and social science, which promulgate a certain worldview which may not be representative of the actual facts on the ground. The Founding Fathers thought that property rights were fundamental. They thought that your rights to life, liberty, and property were of a near absolute quality. And they believed that some taxes, primarily for national defense and perhaps for some infrastructure projects, may be necessary, but they would have been quite shocked with the degree of taxation they see today. And the revolution was sparked by some minor taxes on sugar and tea and legal documents. And if you look at the Founding Fathers, they continually mention your right to life, your right to liberty or freedom, and your right to property as being three major natural rights that a person has. And there's no concept that, you know, life and liberty are important, but property is the sort of right that's granted you by the government or isn't as important as those other rights, because they believe that when you work, you produce property, you gain property. Property is just the fruit of your labor. And so in a large part, it's you as a living being using your natural freedom to produce, and your time is you. So if you spend half your life working for the government, you're half a slave. You've been deprived of your liberty. And by working for the government, I mean working to pay the taxes that the government assesses you for. Who pays taxes? The top 1% pay 38% of the tax, and the top 10% pay 70%. The bottom 50% don't even pay 3%. They pay 2.7%. And almost 50% of people pay absolutely no federal income taxes. So we have a highly progressive and highly graduated tax system that would have made Karl Marx proud. Recall that's one of the planks in the Communist Party's transition to a socialist state, is this idea of a heavily progressive tax system, which the United States in fact has. Laissez-faire capitalism is the idea that the government should not intervene in market transactions at all. So laissez-faire just means let it be. And so the idea is to let the market do its thing, government keep its hands completely off the economy. Collectivism is the idea that the group is the primary unit of value, and that individuals only have value in as much as they are part of a collective. That you have collective rights, but you don't have individual rights. And so socialism is the idea that the means of production should be owned by the workers. And what socialists say is that you need a temporary state in order to redistribute income from rich businessmen. And so the idea is you have in Karl Marx's theory, you have a workers' revolution, a revolution of the proletariat or the working man and the laborer, the factory worker. And what they do is they seize the means of production, the factories, real estate, banks, and then the socialist state will redistribute this income equally and fairly. And then the idea is eventually this state will wither away as people learn to work together. You won't need the state. And you'll have a fully communist system that Marx envisioned is a kind of stateless society where people live communally, people cooperate, and there's no such thing as private property. In the meantime, in the socialist system, there is private property, but produced and distributed. Property is produced and distributed by the state. The communist slogan is each according to his ability, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. So the idea that each person does what they can. If you have skills, say, as a medical doctor, you work as a doctor, and you get just as much compensation as the guy who's sweeping the floor. And then to each according to his need, and so goods are distributed not on the basis of merit, but on the basis of who needs more. So if you have a family of five, you're going to get more than a doctor who might be, say, single. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Class struggle is the struggle of social and economic classes. And Marx says the struggle in our day is between the proletariat, again the working man, and the bourgeoisie, which is a French word which essentially describes rich people, the capitalist class, the business owner, the factory owner, the rich who are not part of the aristocracy. So Marx talks about former times when you had the nobility and wealth was largely inherited, and it's still inherited, but you also have the new rich, people who became wealthy through the Industrial Revolution. The steel magnates, the oil men, the factory owners. Big business and their CEOs and major shareholders. Marx's critiques of capitalism, which I think was the second question. Come back to that for a moment. So this is critiques of capitalism. It was harsh. It led to widespread poverty. That it alienated man from his own labor. You're working in a factory, making something that you're not going to use. It takes people who used to take pride in their accomplishment as a craftsperson, and forces them to do dehumanizing factory work for a very low wage that they can barely live on, enriching the capitalist, who in Marx's view does not have to work but simply sits back counting his money. Why were there only isolated revolutions in places like Russia, China, Cuba, Spain, and South America? It's because Marx didn't really see the emergence of the middle class. And so in Marx's time, you had a vast disparity between rich and poor. And as industrial production increased, you had the emergence of a middle class. And all of a sudden people can buy vast numbers of consumer goods, and there's room for advancement and prosperity, and people have more and more disposable income. And so what you get, I suppose, what now is called trickle-down economics, where the general prosperity of the society reaches down to individuals even at the lowest level. And so the American worker at the various lowest rungs of society is doing much better than a person who might be considered to be pretty well off in some place like South America or China or even Russia today. Communism is said not to be scalable because it seems to work pretty well with a bunch of people who know each other or related to each other. You might think about a family or a group of roommates living together as a kind of a commune. And there are small communes of people united by religious ideas or by social beliefs, who live in small communities, and that seems to work pretty well. And but the problem is when you're dealing with tens of thousands or millions of people, it gets difficult to have the system work, because there's this sort of idea of being part of a system. And communism, the communal way of life, works based on relationships. And if you're living in a large group of people, those relationships don't really work and don't carry as much weight when you're living in a big city. And so although communism might work on a small scale, it's difficult to see it working on a national scale. Which, if any of the major goals of the Communist Party have been realized in America? And the answer is a great deal of them. So you don't have the abolition of real estate, but you do have the federal government owning most of the vacant land in the United States, and you have rent control and landlord-tenant law, which most of the time is slanted towards the tenant. You have a heavily progressive or graduated income tax, certainly. You don't have absolute abolition of all rights of inheritance, but you have a pretty substantial inheritance tax that kicks in at a very low rate. You have a exit tax for millionaires, so although there's not confiscation of all property of people emigrating out of the country, you do have this fairly recent exit tax for people of wealth who are expatriating because the tax rates have become so high. Centralization of credit in the banks of state by means of a national bank. That's the Federal Reserve. We've got that. Centralization of the means of communication. You have talk about an internet kill switch. Transportation in the hands of the state. You have heavily subsidized light rail programs. You have the TSA, who is there groping and frisking you at the airport. Those are all federal workers now. The airports are almost all owned by governments, and the air traffic controllers are also government employees. Extension of factories and instruments of production owned by the state. Well, you have GM, a big car company, now being run by the government, the president replacing the CEO with a handpicked successor. Free public education is one of their planks. And today people don't really think about public education or government schools as a socialist idea. They just see it as normal. And abolition of child labor, you might think, well, you know, communists aren't all bad. And certainly that's something which has occurred. So the main point is a great number of these planks of the Communist Party's platform have all been realized to one degree or another in America. Capitalism and socialism existing in a continuum means that there's no country which is purely capitalist and there is no country which is purely socialist, but you have degrees of capitalism and degrees of socialism. So you get North Korea, which is a pretty strongly socialist state, and say Cuba or Venezuela, pretty strongly socialist states. And then more towards the capitalist side, you might get the European countries like, say, Greece, Portugal, and Spain, still pretty socialist, some capitalism mixed in there. And then you have countries like Germany, France, and Britain, which are sort of moderately socialist. And then you get countries like the United States, which are more towards the capitalist side. And then you get countries which are even more capitalist, like the United States, like the territory of Hong Kong, now owned by the Chinese, but still practicing a stronger form of capitalism. Countries like Singapore, Australia, and New Zealand are a little more towards the capitalist side than America is now, and so on. So you have degrees of capitalism and socialism. Every economy now is a mixed economy. And so you have people that exist along a spectrum from the very socialist to the very capitalist, but again, no country which is completely one or the other. The blogger for Pravda says that the Russians figured out that communism doesn't work. The Americans, on the other hand, have embraced communism without really realizing it. And he talks about how Americans rail about their freedom, they lecture other people about liberty, and yet their freedoms are disappearing more and more every day. And he thinks that America will, the American economy will eventually collapse with Americans bellowing about their freedom as they go into a steady and steep decline. And he attributes that decline to practicing the communism that the Russians figured out does not work. The arguments for the arguments against the Eugene City tax. So one is that 25% of the families who send children to the 4J and Bethel school districts don't live inside the city limits. So those people can't be taxed because they don't live in the city, but their children still go to the schools. Some other criticisms are that it's going to cost $7.2 million to raise $16 million in taxes. And the people who... So this is a pretty expensive way to raise money. There's no infrastructure to gather income tax, so it's going to take some doing to produce that. And it turns out that in order to do this, they're probably going to use a firm up in Portland, so it won't even be jobs in Eugene which will be collecting this tax. It will be people in Portland. It was also mentioned that 44% of only 44% of the school district employees are teachers, so there's a lot of people doing jobs which aren't directly related to teaching, and the idea is you could probably find some money there by laying off some of those people, particularly administrators who get fat salaries and they argue that the budget is top heavy with administrators and they don't have enough teachers. They also suggested that the 6% PERS contribution, PERS stands for Public Employee Retirement System, and the employee kicks in 6% towards their retirement every month, 6% of their salary, and then the employer matches it. There's no legal requirement for them to do that, so they suggested that one way that they could actually close this gap is just by getting rid of the 6% requirement for them to kick in for public employees to pay 6% of their retirement. Jennifer Solomon is a former city councilwoman, and she said that once you create an infrastructure for collecting the tax, it's never going to go away. And the tax is supposedly going to go away in 4 years, but it's unlikely that it will not be renewed once it's created. And finally, the tax is such that it's up to the discretion of the city council what the tax is. So they start out with an initial number, but if that doesn't raise enough revenue, the city council can raise it with just a simple majority vote without consulting taxpayers at all. And Cindy Land made a lot of arguments that people pay a lot of taxes already. The lion's share of state revenues goes towards education, primarily towards K-12. That you have property tax, you have the Proposition 66 and 67 money, you have the state lottery, and there's just all manner of tax money pouring into the schools, and the schools never seem to have enough. So maybe it's time for the schools to tighten their belt and find some way of being more efficient with the money they already have. On the Singer Solution to World Poverty, absolute poverty in developing nations, or the third world, is different from relative poverty of modern industrialized countries like the United States, in that people in absolute poverty can't literally get enough calories to survive, or to have their brains develop properly, or get the right nutrients so they don't go blind from lack of vitamin A, for example. Whereas among America's poor, the primary problem is obesity. And Michelle Obama talks about food deserts and the fact that kids can't get good quality food, that they're eating too much junk food, they're becoming obese, and they're not exercising. Whereas people are literally starving in the third world. Well, no one is starving in America, and there's a social safety net, there's food stamps, and then in any major city, a person who is able-bodied can stand on the street corner and beg for small change and get enough to eat in that way. Or go to a local rescue mission or a local church and get help that way. Or they might even be able to get a job. Whereas in the third world, there aren't a bunch of rich people walking around with money. There aren't a bunch of restaurants filled with food. There are people living in tents, all picking through garbage heaps, relying on foreign aid, and looking for some way to feed their family enough calories for them to survive for the next few days. And if there's a drought or some kind of natural disaster, it means that it may mean that thousands or tens of thousands of people will starve to death in the next few months. So Singer thinks that the solution is for those in the first world to generously give. And he's not talking about government, although he thinks government can do more, but he says this is an obligation of individuals. Because even the people of modest means in the United States can afford to give something, and many people can afford to give quite a lot. What are some responses to the lifeboat ethics objection? And that's one I talked about in class, that at a certain point, you give so much money away, you actually end up harming yourself. And you're just making things worse through creating overpopulation. And Steve Savage said, well, that might sound good in the abstract, but what if it were your family that was starving to death? What if it was your kid who's going to die? Then how would you feel about it? Most people would want to be helped. And so all of this sounds maybe good if you think about it in the abstract. When you think about real human beings dying, and you think about it being your family, it doesn't make it look like a tenable position. The other thing is that overpopulation isn't really a global problem. We could feed, as Steve said, we could feed the world's population today with all the food we're creating now. And it's not a numbers problem. It's not a population problem. It's a distribution problem. Overpopulation is a local phenomenon where the birth rate is high and production is low. What about the excuse you don't know where the money's going? There are many independent charity navigators, independent auditors, who will do an independent audit of the books of various charities and report on how much they spend on administration, how effective they are, and how many of your dollars really get to the people who need them the most. What about the objection that charity starts at home and there's lots of needy people here in the U.S.? Well, as I said, you didn't step over a dead body on your way to school today. So in third world countries, You know, there are literally dead bodies laying in the road. People who've dropped dead of exhaustion because they literally starved to death. There are people who die of preventable diseases, which have been banished from the United States. And again, if you look at the relative poverty in the United States as opposed to the absolute poverty in developing countries, you would think that the aid should go to the people who need it the most. Whereas when you have, and Steve suggested that it's fine to help people in need in the United States, but you should also help people who need it the most. What are Singer's examples of Bob and his Bugatti and Dora and her television set, and what are they supposed to show? So, Bob has this $200,000 Italian sports car. It's really fancy. It's parked on the railroad tracks, and a train is coming. He can do nothing, and if he does nothing, a child will be hit by the train and die. Or he can throw a switch. It will result in the train going onto another track and hitting his Bugatti. And Singer says that if Bob did nothing, you would blame him. You would think he was a bad person. And so, and he says, what's the difference between someone with a nest egg of $200,000, which could save many children's lives, but who, instead of using that money to save lives, simply lets it sit in the bank and accrue interest, or spends it on things to help him enjoy his life? And he says that person is equally guilty for the help they're not giving to starving children. And Dora and her television set is meant to show that even a person of modest means also has a responsibility. So Dora hooks up a street urchin with an adoption agency, and then later realizes that the adoption agency was just a kind of a scam to take the organs from street children and sell them to hospitals to transplant into rich people from Western countries. And Singer suggests that this $300 television set is a big deal to Dora, but still that $300 is not worth a child's life. And that she would rightly feel guilty if she knew that that the service she performed led to the death of this child, even though she got $300 for it. But then Singer also suggests that if you went out to see the movie that this story is from, that you probably blew $20 on tickets and popcorn. And that would have been enough to keep a child alive for a month. Well, aren't you guilty for not helping that child? Because without your help, that child would have died. And, there's children that did die last month because no one was helping them. Charles Krauthammer proposes free trade as the solution to third world poverty. He points to the developing nations of India and China, how they have a burgeoning middle class, and millions are being lifted out of poverty through the power of the free market. And he blames Union Democrats for opposing free trade because it threatens overpaid union workers in America and American factories and American agriculture and so on, which has now to compete with cheaper foreign labor and production. Steve Savlich also said, he was talking about working in Darfur. He said that working in Africa is sort of contagious. It's kind of like a disease, and he hopes everyone catches it. He told the story about starting a school. And how he convinced them, the local population, and particularly these local clerics, Muslim clerics, that it had to be a school for both boys and girls, and that they had to go to school together. He talked about a collateral damage worldview, and the collateral damage worldview is just the idea that it's sad that this happens, but what can I do? And the idea that you think that, oh, well, it's too bad there are starving children. And just to think, but and to not do anything about it. To say, well, that's just the way the world is. And he also thinks that this sort of what can I do question is answerable, that you can do something. And even if you can't save everyone, you can save one person. And you're doing something. Okay, that's it for the review. Went a little long. The test will be open Monday, 9 a.m. And it will close the following Monday at close of labs, 7 p.m. Arrive 1 hour before closing, so that means you have to get there the following Monday at 6 o'clock at the very latest. That's May 16th. 7 p.m. is the deadline. At the very beginning of class, I'm going to go over a few of these things, and then we're going to jump right into discussing feminism.